Hello, welcome to Bare Naked Politics. This is the podcast for people who want to keep up with the headlines, but who aren't necessarily politics experts. I'm Julia Bell, and I'm here to strip it all down and make it make sense for you, for everyone. And today, I want to talk you through this issue that's going to somewhat define this year, the year of 2022, and that is the cost of living going up. How the cost of simply being alive and sustaining yourself in the endeavour of staying alive in this country is quite dramatically getting more expensive. And that is down to a bunch of different factors playing in, but mostly it's down to the price of things increasing, plus a rise in taxes that most of us have to pay each month. Now, you know me, economics isn't necessarily my bag, so I got the fabulously kind and sweet Economist Andy, we're going to call him, Economist Andy, to jump on and explain this to me in nice and simple terms. Now, he ran through the basics, but he also offered some practical tips if you are, you know, if you're extremely concerned about this, as many people rightly are. Now, the big thing, okay, just to give you some context before I get into that, the big thing that's at the crux of this, really, is that the price of gas is increasing. And that's not necessarily because the energy companies are, you know, trying to rip us off by upping the prices for absolutely no reason. They're having to up their prices to stay afloat because they themselves are having to pay more for the gas at wholesale price. And so, of course, you're going to ask, well, why is that happening? Why is wholesale gas prices going up? Well, that's because there's a shortage. And, you know, it's super, super simple and straightforward to understand that if there's a shortage of something, it's going to cost more. When everyone needs that thing and there isn't a lot of that thing, it's going to cost a lot. Now, trust me when I tell you that nobody explains anything better than Ros Atkins of the BBC. This man is a gift to UK politics, genuinely. All of his stuff is on BBC iPlayer. So why would I even try to explain the reasons behind this gas shortage when I can just play you a clip of him?
And those energy prices are rising primarily because the wholesale cost of gas has gone up. That has happened because global gas supplies are down. And there are several reasons for that. First, Europe was unusually cold last winter. That meant a lot of stored gas was used up. Second, replenishing those stores was made harder by low wind speeds. That meant less wind power, and so more gas had to be burned to make electricity. The third reason is there was more demand for gas from Asia, and particularly from China.
There you go. The BBC's Ros Atkins, and he does these kind of explainer specials. They're called Ros Atkins On. They're on iPlayer, and they're heavily shared on social media. You probably recognise his voice. So there you go. That's gas. That's the situation there. Basically, we've used up lots of the gas stores because we had a cold winter in Europe. There's heavy competition for what's left, and we've had to rely more heavily on gas rather than the likes of wind because we haven't had that much wind. So this kind of perfect storm of annoying things that have left us with a shortage and made it more expensive. And that, of course, has put energy companies in a position where they just simply have to charge us more money in order to, you know, keep themselves going. On top of that, though, if you have been, for example, grocery shopping in the UK lately, you may have also noticed that the price of that has gone up and that your receipts may well look steeper than they used to. And that, I think, is a bit more straightforward to understand. The pandemic has royally messed around with a company's ability to maintain a smooth supply chain. In general, it blows my mind that companies manage to have international supply chains with all these different components, you know, processes on the land, road, sea, running in a timely and organised fashion, thousands of people involved getting something from A to B. The idea kind of gives me a headache in normal times. You throw in lockdowns in certain countries, restrictions in others, work absences across the whole supply chain, some countries banning people from coming in and out, other countries banning goods from coming in. I mean, it of course, naturally and obviously plays havoc on, you know, Tesco being able to get you that banana, or a supermarket being able to get you a thing. And then on top of that, if you add in Brexit, then, you know, of course you've got more serious challenges. Things like, I mean, simple things like lorry drivers. I've talked about this quite a lot on the podcast, but lots of lorry drivers in the UK used to be EU workers, people from Poland or Romania or whatever. And then when Brexit happened and the pandemic happened, lots of them either had to leave or wanted to leave. And so you have a shortage of lorry drivers. You don't have the ability to get the thing from the border to the supermarket, to your house. At least it costs more to do that. And, you know, the shortage of lorry drivers has meant that those that are still around are saying, right, you've got to pay me more. So if they're asking for more money, then the lorry driving company has to ask for more money from the supermarket, and the supermarket has to ask for more money from you. So can you see how even things like that, which is in part a result of Brexit, is playing into this? There's lots of different components, but actually once you start to unpack them, they do make a lot of sense. So you've got all of that going on, pretty reductive version of events, and I'm sure you can understand there's actually lots that plays into this. But then if you, on top of that, add in as well the fact that if you are a sort of regular wage earner, i.e. if you get your money and your payslips from working for a company, rather than, for example, a passive income from, say, a property empire, then you will, with your wages, you'll be paying national insurance on your pay packets. It's a separate tax from your income tax. I'm talking about UK residents here. You guys all know what I'm talking about. And the government have said that they are going to up that from April. They're going to up it by 1.25 percentage points. And it's their way of saying, look, the NHS is in dire need of money. We're in quite a lot of debt. This is a way for us to get more money into our pot and pay for all these things. Now, considering there were a multitude of options for how the government would gain this money, you know, they could have, there were different ways that you could get, there are different taxes they could have put on people. And this upping the national insurance thing, is it the most popular decision that the government have ever made? Absolutely not. But this essentially means that even people on 0 hours contracts, as long as they earn more than 10k a year, they will be paying more in taxes than they used to be. Whereas people who solely earn their money from passive incomes, even if it's millions of pounds a year, they won't see a difference in this sense because they don't pay national insurance. So, yeah, that's kind of a bizarre outcome of this decision that the government have made. And you've got many activists who represent low-wage earners who are particularly critical of this and puzzled by it, frankly. They're saying, hang on, doesn't this feel a little bit like you're punishing poorer people? And you've got, like, big swathes of the population who are really loaded who actually aren't going to feel this pinch. And in real terms, what does it mean for us? How's it going to look? Say if you earn 30 grand a year, you're going to be paying £214 more in national insurance alone over the year from April. It is a chunk, and it's totally proportionate as to how much you'll feel this, depending on what you already have and depending on your cost of living already and all that stuff. But it's something that everyone is going to notice who's a kind of regular wage earner. And for that reason, because it kind of affects so many people and such a diverse group of people, I did wonder if the government would change their mind on this, you know, because they were getting backlash from so many different directions. If you want to hear some of that backlash, I do the papers on BBC Radio 5 Live every weekend, and that's a call-in show, usually with Stephen Nolan hosting it. And you've got people calling in from all walks of life, and it's quite rare. In fact, I don't know if I've ever had or if I've ever experienced anyone call in and say, do you know what I love? I love this national insurance increase that's coming in from April. I've never heard anyone say that. So because it is kind of really quite widely unpopular, it seems, not just in the public, but also amongst MPs from all parties, including some in the Conservative Party, I did wonder if the government would change their mind. But they're not going to. On Saturday, the 29th of January this year, 2022, Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, so the man in charge of our money, and Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, co-wrote a piece in the Sunday Times that basically said, look, stop questioning this, it's happening. It was titled, quote, "We must stick to our recovery plan. Tax will rise to pay for it." So you know, those are some of the components. National insurance is going up. Is it popular? Not necessarily amongst big groups, but it's happening. It's going to cost people more. Gas is going to cost people more. Food is going to cost people more, amongst lots of other things. That's a bit of context as to why people are talking about this year as the, quote, year of the squeeze. Andy, economist Andy, helps me unpack that in this episode. And then at the end, I'll run you through some of the government's approaches and recent announcements. Please do make sure you've hit subscribe on whatever platform you like to listen to this on, and click 5 stars, please, if you're listening on Spotify or if you're listening on Apple Podcasts. It's like the little rating you can do. It takes you about 0.5 seconds and it massively helps me because it makes the podcast just ultimately easier to discover for people who, let's be honest, may well really benefit from it, because if I say so myself, it can be quite a helpful resource for understanding politics. And with that being said, I'll play you my chat with Andy. I started our conversation by asking him very simply what this phrase, the cost of living crisis, actually truly means.
Well, it essentially means that inflation is going up, which basically means the price of the things we buy is going up, and it's going up at a rate that's higher than it usually does. And it basically means that if wages, the income that you earn, is not going up as quickly as that, then your income essentially is going down. So people are not able to afford the same things they used to afford. And it's the big things, like you said, food, energy bills, electricity, gas, your fuel, price of petrol is going up, price of a train ticket is going up, the price of secondhand cars. There's lots of random things in this basket of goods that they measure for inflation that are going up. I think the one that gives most people concern is the energy costs that are going up, because pretty much everything needs energy. So if that cost is going up, it potentially means the cost of everything is going to go up.
Yeah, I remember seeing a thing about this soup company that was saying, we're going to have to charge more for our soup because cooking the soup costs gas, and gas is costing us so much money that we can't afford it. So having to just up the price, and the consumer's going to have to face that bill. So it's not even just a matter of, you know, little old me in my flat having to pay more money to heat the flat. It's also, I'm going to have to pay more money for my soup because the people who make it have to pay that gas bill. You know, it's all rippling across all of us.
Yes, exactly.
And is this something that you predicted? Is this something that economists knew was coming around the corner? You know, have we known about this for months, or was it kind of a surprise?
Yeah, I think from the forecasts that we're looking back at forecasts in previous years, I think it's something to be expected, just because of the way that the pandemic has, as I said, halted some of that supply chain that feeds into the cost inputs for goods around the world. I think also that basically whenever the economy kind of gets halted and it becomes into the recovery stage, you can imagine lots of people weren't spending the same amount of money, so they've been kind of saving it. And once they're kind of free to go and spend again, it kind of injects cash into the economy, and that generally pushes up prices. So throughout history, you always see just after the kind of end of a recession, which we're now just coming out of, there's usually that kind of increase in prices that come.
One thing that I thought was a really good question, Katie on Instagram asked, is this a UK problem? This inflation problem and the energy crisis and just generally cost of living going up, is this a UK problem or is it more global?
One of the big things is this energy crisis, energy price crisis. So everyone needs their gas and electricity and their oil to create the electricity. And if those things are going up, then that's going to be a global issue. And that's going to be the kind of key feeder into all production. So it would be affecting a lot of different countries.
And is that better for us if everyone's affected, or is it kind of worse because none of us can fish anyone else out of the nightmare?
Yeah, I would say it was worse, because if you imagine, if you want to go and buy a product, if it's going up in the UK, you might go, oh, I'll just go buy it from China.
Yeah.
If their prices are also going up because the costs of their inputs are going up, then you can't exactly get anything cheaper.
What's so upsetting is about this is it's the kind of thing that it feels quite powerless. And that's what's so annoying about economics, Andy. And this is why I don't know how you can do it for a living, is that we're moaning about something that feels beyond our control. And yet humans invented money. We invented money. We invented trade. We invented markets. Therefore, the byproducts of these things, like inflation and costs of living going up, are doing.
That's a really good way of putting it, because essentially we do control the supply of money. And when I say we, I mean, well, the Bank of England and the government control the supply of money. And if, since they can do that, and the way they control it is through the interest rates. So the lever that the Bank of England have is if the prices are going to go up, they can increase interest rates.
Right.
And that is their, that's how they control inflation. And similarly, if they want to put like create growth in the economy, they'll put the interest rates down. That helps everyone borrow for way cheaper. And that means they can get money and spend it.
Right.
The opposite's true when they want to control inflation. The problem this time, though, is that it's more like it's a kind of global problem. Like, putting up interest rates is not really going to solve the price of energy going up. So they're aware of that. And they're also aware they've just kind of came out or are at the end of this pandemic for now. And they're worried about if we increase interest rates, that's going to kind of slow down economic growth that we kind of need at this time.
So what's it, this is the thing. What are governments doing? What's a wise thing to do at this point? Is it a kind of just grit your teeth and bear it and it'll be over in a year? Or does serious policy need to be put into place to stop us all from, you know, not being able to afford a week's groceries?
Yeah, well, I think we've not touched on this point yet, but the other thing that's looming in the very near future is the price cap on energy is going to be changing on from the 1st of April.
And when you say price cap, is that the government saying, look, we're not, even though the price of gas is mental, we're not going to let you spend more than this because we're going to intervene? Is that what you mean by a price cap?
Yeah, that's a kind of government intervention into the market to say, we don't want you to kind of rip off consumers, but the energy companies will say something, you can't have that forever because the cost, the wholesale prices that we're buying it, just makes it not possible. That means it's not profitable for us to do it anymore. So we're going to have to relook at this price every 6 months.
And the government, it's not like the government can force energy companies to make a loss, because the government also needs energy companies to turn a profit to stay in business. If they all went bust, we'd all be screwed. So it's not, the government only has so much leverage with this.
Exactly. And essentially, they're forecasting, it's all based on basically the wholesale rates of gas and energy. So they can kind of predict what it's going to be. And they're expecting it to go up by 50%. So that's your, that's your bills going up by 50%.
Who's forecasting that? Economists or the government?
Everyone.
Right.
No, they're pretty certain of it, because it's based on like a 6 month rate. So if that happens, yeah, that's going to increase bills by quite a lot. Mm. And again, in 6 months later, so when it hits October, again, they'll have to change the price cap, and they're expecting that to go up even further. And they're talking about forecasts of your energy bills going up by thousands of pounds, and it's quite scary. So going back to your original question about what the government could do, well, usually, as I say, when it comes to inflation, they would look to the Bank of England to raise interest rates, but that's really not going to do much. So what can they do? They're going to have to basically help people pay their bills. And I would imagine that it's going to affect people who are the kind of poorest in society, people on benefits, who spend a higher proportion of their income on paying their energy bills. And the average household spends about 6% of their weekly income on energy bills.
Yeah.
After the price cap removes, I think it's going to be like 10%. But for the poorest households, it's going to be like double that, like 20%, 25%. So imagine every pound that you get in, every £4 you get in, £1 straight out the door on your energy.
Oh my God. And that's just to keep the house warm and just to cook your food. And wow. Okay, so the government are kind of backed into a corner here. They're, the sort of temporary-ish solutions are, we'll put a price cap on energy, but we can't keep that forever. We're going to have to keep moving the goalposts because energy companies are held hostage by how much this costs for them. So that's one avenue that isn't perfect. The other avenue is that the government pumps money into our pocket so we can pay our bills. Again, not perfect because the government only has a pot that's so deep and we've just been through a pandemic, so it's not like they're rolling in it either. Is there anything else? What can be done?
Yeah, there's not much. I think we're going to have to hope that they can find money from somewhere, borrow some more money in order to help the kind of the ones who need it most. For everyone else, I think it might be a bit of gritting your teeth. Maybe ask for higher wages if you can.
I mean, this is the thing. You kind of said it as a joke, ask for more money. But that's serious, right? If you're working for a huge company that has made a profit over the last couple of years, then naturally, they are the people that have deeper pockets than anyone else. And if you're working for an institution like that, wouldn't it be genuine advice to go to your employer and say, look, if I'm one of the poorest members of society, every £4 I get, a quid of that is going to be going into my energy bills. Pay me more money.
I think, join a union, collective bargaining power is always a good way to get higher wages. And the good thing is, on the positive, I've been very kind of negative, and I think on the positive side, the economy is looking okay. Unemployment is still very low, which is good when it comes to negotiating for higher wages.
Mm.
And it means there's like a smaller supply of labour. That means they have more power to say to the firm that they want higher wages. Because the firm can't just go, no, we're going to fire you because there's other people out there.
Because there aren't other people out there.
Yep. The thing is, it's very unlikely that you're going to get a wage increase that's as high as inflation's going up, which is expected to go up to about beyond 6%, 7%. So that's quite a high wage jump that you would need. And just on the other side, though, if you think about the kind of cost of production for firms, most of the money that they spend is on wages, is on people that they hire. So if you're asking for more wages, that means that they might potentially, in order to afford that, have to put their prices up because their costs are going up.
Oh my God. So like this soup company, if someone listening to this works for that soup company, then they'll be saying, I'm already having to pay more money for my gas. If I have to pay more money for you, I'm going to have to hike up the money for the consumer. The consumer won't be able to pay for the soup. They'll be going to their employer asking for more money. And so the cycle goes on.
Quite the pickle.
I mean, this is the question, though. All these boffins who are working away and who have, to some degree, predicted this, because like you say, there are kind of economic norms and trends that are at play here. Surely if this was somewhat foreseen that we would have this problem, then surely there are people out there who know when this might end. Is there an end in sight? Is there a light at the end of the tunnel for this?
I'm not sure. To be honest, I don't think it's worth listening to anyone who's going to predict things beyond more than a year, because anything can happen. So I'm not going to come on and just start putting on wild predictions about what potentially could happen. I think the big thing is this energy price cap. I think that's going to be the thing that's going to affect people's bills the most. So that would be the thing I'd be looking towards in terms of how is the government going to solve that issue, because the markets are not going to do anything about it. It needs government intervention. So let's see what happens up to that point, and then we can maybe make some more long-term predictions after that.
Okay. Miss Vix on Instagram asked, how can people realistically find out what help is available to them?
I would say the Citizens Advice Bureau. Probably a very good place to go at the start, and they'd probably give you advice of if you're needing extra money, about where you can potentially apply for additional funding, warm home discount, all these other bits of money that are out there, how to kind of save on your bills, all that. So I would say that's probably a good first port of call if you're looking for advice.
Okay, that's actually really helpful. Thank you. Oh, I feel like every time we speak, it's so bleak.
I know. This is what life of an economist is like.
Economist Andy there. And I know a lot of what he had to say was, it was anything but uplifting, but I hope you came away with just lots more understanding and a couple of practical tips too. On this energy price crisis, I just want to revisit it because the fact that the cap on that we have to pay is changing come April is a massive component to this. Andy did touch on it, but I want to hammer it home because that is what's going to feel, quite frankly, like a bit of a hammer blow when April rolls around for a lot of people in the UK. So like Andy said, this price cap was the device where the government basically forced energy companies not to be able to charge us, the consumer, over a certain amount of money for our household bills. So, you know, energy companies would have to foot the difference of the bill if need be. But of course, we've seen over the last few months, energy companies go bust. Certain energy companies go bust. So there was this fear that, okay, this price cap, the way that it currently is unsustainable. And now here we are marching towards April, where that cap is indeed going to lift, meaning in real terms, guys, and this is the painful bit, energy bills are going to cost about £700 more for the year for the average household. And I just tried to, you know, I know that I feel like a lot of news anchors and people don't necessarily listen to the words that they're saying, the severity of what they're saying. And I'm just trying to really let that sink into myself, the words I'm telling you, because £700 is not small change. You know, I know you're splitting it up over 12 months, but still, if you're earning a low wage, 700 quid is a massive proportion of your entire income. And I repeat again, £700 is what will be added to the average household's yearly energy bills. So the government have sort of had their hand forced. The price cap's rising. It is what it is. It's going to cost us more. What can we do? What policies are we going to roll out? Well, on the 3rd of February, which was incidentally my 30th birthday, so I hope you don't mind, but I wasn't massively paying attention to this on the day. I did not want to think about this. But Chancellor Rishi Sunak stood in the House of Commons and shared his plan. This is what he said.
Mr. Speaker, the price cap has meant that the impact of soaring gas prices has so far fallen predominantly on energy companies. So much so that some suppliers who couldn't afford to meet those extra costs have gone out of business as a result. It is not sustainable to keep holding the price of energy artificially low. Mr. Speaker, without government intervention, the increase in the price cap would leave the average household having to find an extra £693. The actions I'm announcing today will provide to the vast majority of households just over half of that amount, £350. In total, the government is going to help around 28 million households this year. Taken together, this is a plan to help with the cost of living worth around £9 billion.
So there you go, around £9 billion of support on this issue, the cost of living crisis issue, particularly on energy bills. And there are different levels to it. There's different components to it. So, for instance, 80% of households, they happen to be those in council tax bands A to D, they will receive a tax rebate of £150 this spring. So that's some of that money. We'll also see households get £200 discount on their energy bills in October. Now, do you remember when economist Andy was saying, you know, things could even get steeper by October? So this discount is the hope that it would at least temporarily soften the blow of that. But of course, energy companies are going to be able to charge us more and more and more. So it really is a temporary blow soften. It's not going to kind of drastically change our lives in the long term, I'm afraid. Do you know the other thing actually that's worth mentioning that members of the government have sort of put forward to try and ease the pain of the cost of living? And that is the Culture, Media and Sport Secretary, Nadine Dorries. She is massively pushing this policy of hers that is to freeze the price of the licence fee to pay for the BBC. I've talked about this in podcasts prior, but obviously, again, the way that it works in the UK, and I feel like international listeners are always kind of fascinated by this because it's quite a unique system that we've got. But we all pay essentially a tax on our TV. So once you buy a TV, you kind of have to, by law, buy a TV license. And it's about 100 and odd quid a year. I can't remember if it's like 140, 150 quid a year. And that is what allows you to then use all BBC content, consume all BBC content, everything from the radio to the news to the apps to sport to drama, all of it. That comes along with your TV license. And Nadine Dorries has said, look, I can see that inflation is rising, but I'm not going to make the punters pay any more for the BBC. I'm not going to have the BBC license fee rise in line with inflation. We're going to freeze it. And then she's saying, actually, come 2027, we need a whole new system. I think we should scrap the license fee. That's what she's saying. And you know, that puts the BBC in a position where they're like, oh, so are we going to have to start playing adverts and get money from private companies? Or are we going to have to become a subscription service like Netflix? That's the sort of debate happening at the moment. There aren't any concrete answers. But bottom line, Nadine Dorries is saying, you shouldn't be paying too much money for the BBC. That shouldn't be a priority. That's going to assist with the cost of living. Let me know how you feel about that. I think it's a very interesting debate. You've got people on one side very passionately who are saying, yes, this is what we needed. I don't want to have to pay for the BBC. I don't use the content. I don't like the content. And I need that money to pay my energy bills. Other people are saying, well, hang on. The BBC is our publicly owned broadcaster. And they are, you know, the ones that can be completely free to hold the government to account and to scrutinise the government. Plus all the other things we get from it, like the drama and the radio and all that stuff. We need it. And it's not that much money in real terms across the course of the year. 150 odd quid. So let's keep it. You know, there's such passionate sides on both sides of this debate. Really keen to hear your thoughts on that. Anyway, that's something. But truly none of these measures are going to completely protect many people, if anyone, from the cost of living crisis. The big squeeze is coming, and I don't think there are many people that are completely safe from that, especially middle and low income earners. And so for that reason, I think that the pressure on the government to do more is going to build, especially when April comes and people really start feeling that difference and, you know, actual people start having to reevaluate their monthly budgets and go, oh my God, this is how much I'm spending each month. Oh, wow. You know, they start actually feeling it, seeing it. So I would say keep an ear out for any new announcements. I wonder if this truly is the end of it or if they're going to come to April and go get backlash and go, oh, hang on, we need to do more. We'll see. I really liked Andy's advice about, you know, if you are concerned, please get guidance from the Citizens Advice Bureau. There are also charities that, you know, you may well be eligible to receive support from. And I also, just touching on this, I found the comment about asking for more money from your employer quite compelling. And like, again, what do I know? I'm not an economist. And I obviously, Andy did say that if you ask your employer for more money, then they may well have to start charging more for their service or for their goods, which will cost the consumer more. So that's the trade-off. But still, I think that the idea has merit. I was very interested to see that the governor of the Bank of England was asked about this concept. You know, should people be asking for more money? And he said, no, people should not be asking for big pay rises because that is going to be detrimental for the economy. But that didn't, I mean, that went down like a lead balloon, frankly, because it came out very swiftly after he did that interview that the governor of the Bank of England, his name's Andrew Bailey, earned 575 grand in the year from March 2020. So people were going, well, hang on. Little old, you know, Susan, who works at the checkout at the supermarket, who's earning 19k, isn't quite in the same ballpark as you, Mr. Bailey. So I think it's compelling. I'm also assuming that lots of my listeners, I know a few things from the analytics, lots of my listeners are young women. And young women are famous for not being very good at asking for more money. So I reckon that there's probably people listening to this, and I wonder if you there are one of them, who maybe has been working at your company for a while, and maybe you might even be unaware of the fact that there's a chance that your company actually has a process in place to negotiate your pay with you, but you can't get that process underway until you ask. So it's like there's an episode of The Office about this where, I don't know if you watch The American Office, but Michael Scott, the character played by Steve Carell, it comes to light that he's worked for this company for like 14 years and never asked for any more money. And so he ends up earning a similar wage to, you know, the people in the warehouse, and he manages the whole place. And then it becomes clear to him that, oh, I have to ask for it, and then I actually will get quite a lot more money. So maybe, you know, don't be Michael Scott. C, I would say, but like I say, economics isn't exactly my forte. Don't blame me if you set up a meeting and you personally result in your company having to, you know, charge a tenner per pot of lentil soup. Okay, on that, I think that's enough information. I wish I had better news. I truly do, and it does hurt me a little bit when I have to do these podcasts for you that kind of cover particularly bleak topics. But what I will say is, if you're listening to this and you've got to this point, then you've done yourself an absolute service, especially if you didn't really understand or follow a lot of this stuff before, because now you've at least got a foundational understanding of what is coming if you're a UK resident. And sort of burying your head in the sand is the worst thing you can do. That doesn't help anybody. So I commend you on that. Keep in touch with me. I'm on social media at @JuliaBell_X. I will be coming at you quite soon with an episode explaining this tension. Tension's an understatement, brewing on the Ukrainian border. You know, what is this question around? What are Russia's intentions towards Ukraine? Why is there such a big Russian military presence building up on that border? So you'll have an episode on that very shortly. And before I go, I will just mention, if you want to keep this podcast going, and if you can afford to buy me a coffee per month, for example, please do become a patron. The link is in the episode description. There's a bunch of bonus content on there for you to enjoy and to help you stay extra informed. I'm usually my most opinionated self on Patreon, so you are absolutely always welcome to become a part of this community if this podcast helps you and you want to keep it going. So thank you in advance to those of you who decide to do that. Take care of yourself, and I'll speak to you in the next one. Goodbye.